jurisdiction of Warrior Connection. This is Doug Rocky, and I'm coming from the bright and sunny and warm state of Illinois today. And again, respect is what you're always going to have. That's what the veterans always get on Warrior Connection. Well, tonight we're going to step back in history a little bit, and we're going to go back to the Vietnam War and discuss some events around the Vietnam War and the horror of the POW issues and everything associated with the Vietnam War. Denise, have you been able to join us by chance? Okay, I'm not sure where Denise, she might be traveling or anything. Well, I'd like to welcome Mike McNeely. Mike, welcome to Warrior Connection.
Thank you, Doug. Glad to be on here.
Glad to have you.
Yes, sir.
Well, you know, back a long time ago, our good old President Eisenhower got involved in Southwest Asia with the French and everything, and things continued to heat up. And then President Kennedy came along, and obviously the Vietnam era began, and that continued on with extensive more involvement as a consequence of President Johnson and Secretary McNamara at that time, and then continued on with President Nixon and everything else until we finally got out of there. And one of the horrors of all the stuff that happened, I know it personally has affected all of us that were involved in Vietnam, was the POW issues. Well, Mike, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your history and how you got involved with these POW issues?
Yes, Doug. I went in the Marine Corps in 1963, 4 years active duty. How that 4 years, I spent 26 months, 13 days overseas. Of that 26 months, 13 days, I spent 20 months in Vietnam, going in, making raids, and also on land. And so I went over to Okinawa in 1964. Yes, the first part of 1964, on a regular 13-month tour to Camp Swab, Okinawa, with 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines. And while there in June of 1964, my company, Keitel Company, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines, we were sent into Vietnam, and our base area was at Da Nang, at an area called Dog Patch, and they flew us up to Khe Sanh. And part of half the group stayed there at Khe Sanh, half out of us. They flew us over to an area called Tiger Tooth Mountain, which was a highest elevation peak in northern South Vietnam. We were 2 miles from Laos and 10 miles from North Vietnam. We were the second combat unit in Vietnam. We replaced Golf Company, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines, also out of Camp Swab. But there were other troops in Vietnam, such as advisors. We were not advisors, but we were called Advisory Team 1. And the man in charge of us turned out to be later on, he was a Commandant of the Marine Corps. At that time in Vietnam, though, he was Major Al Gray, Jr. And then we stayed on land there for 3 or 4 months. After that, we floated off the coast until the first part of 1965. We rotated back to Camp Pendleton, California, to 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines. And, of course, you know, in March, the first supposedly troops landed in Vietnam, combat troops, and Vietnam heated up, and my outfit, 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines, went head back over there in 65, and I got transferred into our Raider Company in our battalion, Echo Company, 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines, and we were supposed to pull 5, I found out later we were supposed to pull 7, but we ended up pulling 4 raids up and down the coast of Vietnam, anywhere from 80 miles north of Saigon all the way to the DMZ, and then our first major operation, land operation in Vietnam was in December 1965 as Operation Harvest Moon, which is southwest of Da Nang, and then on that for 10 days, and we pulled out of there and landed into Phu Bai, which is up there just south of the Imperial City of Hue. And my last operation was Operation Hastings, started July 15, 1966. And my last night was actually the 22nd. I got wounded on the 21st of July by an 82-millimeter mortar. And we had 2 dead and 13 of us wounded. And I got hell lifted out about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning on the 22nd back to, I think, Dong Hall, the 3rd Med, and he'll lift me out to the SS repos, and then I eventually got back stateside about the 15th or 20th of August. I had 9 days left to do in Vietnam when I got wounded, and was stationed at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, 2nd Battalion, 2nd Marines, and I got discharged in 1967. And that was my time in the Marine Corps, and I almost got captured twice when I was in Vietnam. The last dagger thrust raid we pulled, you know, when you're young and you're out there and you play hide and seek at nighttime, well, that's what we were trying to do against, I think, the North Vietnamese. And when you're hearing them out there crawling through the bushes at night and it's pitch black and dark and you can't see nothing, you know they're close. And then the last time I almost got captured over there was the night I got wounded. The North Vietnamese were fixing to surround us and this other company. At that time, I was in hotel company, 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines, and we were tied in my old company, Echo Company 2-1. And we were as a blocking force. And I had two machine gun teams in my gun squad. I was a squad leader at that time. And the North Vietnamese had opened up on us that night with small arm fire, 50 caliber fire. And when they stopped that, they dropped in the mortars. And that's when I got hit. And the mortars landed right in on me and this Mexican buddy of mine. His name was Pedro Martinez, who was from Mercedes, Texas. Well, I knew I got hit in the left side of my head, my left leg, my right arm, and Martinez, he lived for about 2 minutes, and he died, and ended up like we had two dead and 13 of us wounded in about 15 minutes' time. Well, they had to bring our listening post back in. I had one of my gunners out on a listening post, and he was an Indian. His name was B.J. Fowler, and they brought the listening post back in, and Fowler told me, said, Mac, he said, I could reach out and touch him. He almost stepped on me talking about the North Vietnamese. Well, they were going to go around and try to surround us in this other country and try to overrun us. Well, I'm proof, and he's proof, and them other guys that come out there were proof they didn't get their job done. And it ended up the North Vietnamese lost about 900 men, and we lost, I think, about right around 125 KIAs on that operation. And that's the second time I almost got captured, and when I got out of the Marine Corps, I didn't think much about going on. I just went about my life, and then in 1983, I went up to the Vietnam Memorial because I wanted to see the name on that wall of the guy that I served with. There's quite a number of guys I knew that got killed over there, and I'd seen these Vietnam vets talking about we had a live American prisoner of war in Southeast Asia. Well, I didn't think much about it at that time, but I was concerned. And I went back up a second time, and I ran into Captain Red McDaniel, who was shot down on the 81st Combat Mission over North Vietnam. And I told myself, these guys need some help, and I'm going to get involved, and I've been involved ever since. And I'm going to let you pick it up from here and go from there.
Well, you had quite a hairy time. I know I enlisted in 1967, and then by the time I finished all my specialized schooling in the Air Force, I went on my first arc light deployment in March of 1969. Came back for 6 months, and then went back over on my second full tour in the Air Force on Thanksgiving Day of 1969, and then stayed over there till June of 1971. So that's almost, I mean, right about this time, we're coming up on June, and I was finishing my last combat mission and getting on my way coming home right about this time. And that's, wow, 1971. But the one night I remember, we had more than one hairy time and everything, but November 20th, 1970, I was involved in the diversionary bombing missions while they went into Sante Prisoner of War Camp, which is about 40 miles northwest of Hanoi. And we had a real bad day, and our aircraft was on fire. We got the fire put out, and we got limped back to base and got there. But trying to come back and remember all of those memories, and then the same as you, when I finally got up to the wall in the early 80s, we were at a conference up in Washington, D.C. for the university. And my other buddy and I, his brother was up there on the wall, and the two of us went on down there to look at that from the conference. You know, we're at the big conference center. So anyhow, all this stuff just brings back memories for all of us. That's over 40 years ago. And the POW issue is still not resolved, is it?
No, it's not resolved, and it probably will never be. It will never be resolved honorably. And the reason I say that, I know, and the people I work with on behalf of prisoners of war missing action know that our government walked off and left live American prisoners of war, not only in Southeast Asia and Vietnam War, but also in Korea and also World War II.
There's still a lot of Americans missing from the Korean War, correct?
That's correct. We knew in the latter part of the 90s that we had between 13 and 15 live Americans still in Korea, and we had people that were willing to go over and negotiate the release of those prisoners of war from the Korean War, the one that I just mentioned.
Do they have, I know in my own case, because I was on B-52s, but we had quite a few crew members that obviously got shot down. For me, I guess the most memory I have is when I came back in 1971 and went to college, and then the grade school my wife was teaching at that time, this was in January 1973. So right after Christmas, I mean, just Christmas break, we had a local state police officer came in to do the, you know, the holiday quick safety thing for driving safety, winter safety and everything. And after everybody got introduced and the whole thing, and his state police from Illinois, his name was Larry Lind, and everybody's introduced, and he said, Doug Rocky, are you the flying squirrel? And I go, how would you know that? And then he related that his brother Robert Lind had just been shot down in Linebacker 2 just a couple weeks before in December of 1972, and that was a pretty horrific thing because his brother had written home about, you know, our interactions and, you know, flying together and stuff we had done when we were flying out of Utapau Air Force Base in Thailand. So that's a long time ago. Do they have any idea the total number of American POWs that were captured, total number of our guys who were captured during the Vietnam War?
Well, the figure we initially had, I think it was somewhere around 2,500. And you have people dispute the figures, you know. Knowing our government, their figures are usually not accurate. And but the figures the government come out with is, I think it's 2,500 that the government come out with, and basically figures we're going with because that's the one they provide us with. We don't know about special operation where the people are not known. So we're going to go with the 2,500 that the government come out with.
Now, when everybody came back, I remember in 1973 when the Hanoi taxi brought everybody back. That's only a little over 300 or something like that.
In 1973, there was 591 come home.
Okay. So, I mean, we're looking at incredible numbers of people that never had any accounting and everything.
Correct. Our government was actually expecting a lot more than that, and but Nixon said that in 1973 that all of our live prisoners of war were home. That was not correct. And he had Henry Kissinger to hand carry a letter up there to North Vietnam offering $3.25 billion in reconstruction aid for the remaining prisoners of war. Well, politics being politics, well, neither side trusted each other, and we didn't give them the money, the aid that we agreed to, and they didn't give us the prisoners of war. Well, that's how they held them back. You know, you don't give me the money, you don't get these live prisoners of war, and that's been a stalemate ever since. But we do know that our government did, in fact, leave live American prisoners of war in Southeast Asia. That's a fact that the government can't dispute because that's their word and that's documented.
Yeah, there was a book, I've got a copy in front of me here, An Enormous Crime. I guess it's pretty much a definitive discussion that was written by a former U.S. Congressman, Bill Hendon, and Elizabeth Stewart, that discusses all of this. And in there, and I mean, I'm looking at the cover right now, and what they show is you know, aerial photography and everything, where we have messages actually being carved into fields and everything from the POWs. Is that kind of a common occurrence, or is that those photos and those things seem to be pretty prevalent?
I agree wholeheartedly with Congressman Hendon. He is a good friend of mine. He's a congressman from northwestern part of North Carolina, and I met him and also Beth Stewart a numerous times at POW function up in D.C. That information, he's not speculating on that. That's I go along with everything he says there. And what our people in our government try to do, they try to shoot down anybody who comes out with legitimate information on live American POWs. And I, along with a lot of people, activists that work on behalf of prisoners of war, agree with Congressman Hendon.
I think one of the things that was most disturbing for me, because, I mean, both you and I mean, you were a few years ahead of me, but we were very young puppies, as along with everybody else that went to Vietnam. We had all those idealistic binges and everything on our brain. The 60s were a tumultuous lifestyle for all of us, just from everything was involving going through high school. I know when I got out of high school, and probably the same thing for you, I mean, any idea going on to college at that time was a dream, because unless you could somehow get a deferment, you knew you were one way or another. If you didn't get if you didn't enlist in the military, you were sure going to get drafted pretty fast. And
yeah,
once you get drafted, the probability of heading over to Vietnam without adequate training, not adequate information or anything was 100%.
Me being a Marine infantry, that's what we trained for, and I had a lot of training there in Okinawa and also down there in the Philippines for guerrilla warfare. But the real training you get is when you go in actual combat. That's where you get your wake-up call, so to speak. And yes, I did. You know, I expected it. Well, if you're a Marine machine gunner, Well, what do you carry a machine gun for? So we were expecting to get shot at, and hopefully minimize our casualties. That's what we were trying to accomplish, and maximize our opponents.
Doug, this is Denise. I've called in.
Welcome, Denise. Mike, this is Denise Nichols. Denise has been involved in the POW issues forever and ever and ever. Also, Denise, you were actually providing care for as everybody came back to Wilford Hall, weren't you?
Right, long time ago. And I am vice chairman of the National Vietnam and Gulf War Veterans Coalition, which includes Rolling Thunder. And I know Billy Hendon very well. He gave us a private tour after a luncheon meeting up there all the way up to the top of the Capitol. So Billy is a friend of mine, and I have had his book. I recommend it to everybody. I think it's one of the best books out there. And I truly believe that there hasn't been an accounting. I was just looking while I was waiting to have a chance to talk about the numbers. And we're seeing, I think, 528 that they claim were missing in Laos. The PEVLAO said they had 158. So, you know, they did not adequately account for it, and people are still taking the effort to keep the pressure on for answers and not so much just the returns of the remains. That's kind of what the VA done, is push VA and DSP pushed on the return of the remains. So it's more than the coalition group believes that there are some held somewhere, and they still work on it. And there was a lot of talk that people use that as a means of making money. That's how the POW groups were kind of maligned. And it was never like that for the Vietnam vets that actually got involved wanting answers, wanting our people returned and fully accounted for. And I think we can thank the Vietnam vets and those that served before that also served in Vietnam, like John Holland, samples, that kept pushing and wanted to get answers and had never given up. Top John Holland worked on the Missing Servicemen's Personnel Act for 13 to 14 years of his life.
Yeah, Top was also, he had a thing right up there at the Vietnam War, I know forever and ever, because Denise, you and I, we had the opportunity, stayed with Top when we were up there one time. And, that was a very emotional time to be one of the greatest heroes in American history, that he was. Mike.
Yes, sir.
As you've been involved in everything, going back from long before Denise and I got involved, what have you noticed or seen? Why did the whole POW issue turn into such a nightmare? We know today the Gulf of Tonkin incident did not occur. That McNamara and Johnson make that all up, voted to get involved, and everything just deteriorated from there on out, where we were all got involved in this stuff. But do you have any idea from all of your work over all these years on why the government would go the direction they have gone on the POW issues?
Well, you got people in this government in my opinion, and the number of people that I've worked with on behalf of prisoners of war, such as Top Holland and Billy Hendon, Ted Sampley, Dolores Alphonse, and Colonel Earl Hopper Sr., whose son is still missing in action over North, he was shot down over North Vietnam. We feel that beyond a shadow of a doubt, you had people in our government trying to cover this up and shoot down the messenger. Well, in 1973, Nixon said all of our live American prisoners of war were home. Well, the incident happened in 1979 to prove him wrong. And the incident was, do you remember the guy by the name of Bobby Garwood? Bobby Garwood was a Marine that slipped out a note, who had been captured in 65, while he was up in North Vietnam. He was able to slip out a note to some businessman over in Europe who was passing through there, and that's how Bobby Garwood was able to get out. Bobby Garwood, he beat two governments, theirs and ours. And they brought him back here, and they shot the messenger, which was Bobby Garwood, to carry him at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and court-martialed him. I liked him being a Marine. I thought he was a traitor all that time. And I got involved in prisoners of war, I found out that Bobby Garwood actually beat two governments on getting out of Vietnam. And Bobby Garwood, I apologized to him face to face up in Washington, D.C., because I found out that our government was lying to the American people. And they tried to shoot anybody down as far as their information on live American prisoners of war. And they have never prosecuted anybody. And just like the names we had called out from Billy Hendon up to Colonel Hopper, Ted Slamp, and John Holland, they have never prosecuted anybody for falsifying their information on prisoners of war. And they know they're wrong, and they know we can beat them at their game. But they just don't want the information to come out for whatever reason. I don't know if it'd be embarrassing to a number of presidents or whatever, but that could be the case. I'm not sure.
I remember the Rolling Thunder when Sammy Davis Jr., Medal of Honor recipient, and Bobby Garwood was right up there by the reflection pool, and Bobby was having a hard time. And here, the Medal of Honor recipient, Sammy Davis, reached up, put his hand onto Bobby's shoulder, and said, "You can go on." And it was the most emotional thing I've ever seen. I'm honored to have met Bobby and Sammy Davis, and feel like at times I just walk in their shadows, and they've encouraged me to keep going with the Gulf War illness situation.
Mike, Sammy's a good friend of yours, isn't he?
Yes.
Pardon me? Sammy Davis, he's the, he and I, first time I met him, he's a very good friend of mine, and we keep in touch on a weekly basis. First time I met him was at a POW function up here in D.C., and I told myself, I said, here's a Medal of Honor recipient that's worked on behalf of prisoners of war, and we established a good friendship, and we've been highly associated with each other, and I've had him come down here in the early 90s and speak on behalf of prisoners of war at my VFW post here at Bailey, North Carolina. And we keep in touch on a continuous basis, and he is another American hero. He's highly been involved in field deputy, highly respected not only by those in the Army, but also people that work on behalf of prisoners of war, and he has my utmost respect.
Yeah, I was very lucky. Again, this is working with Denise and everything. I mean, I had the opportunity. I met Command Sergeant Major Kettleson, who, again, is, you know, he led the raids, and he's gone in and done so many raids with POWs trying to retrieve them, you know, his career and everything else. And then, again, with Rolling Thunder and everything, I think one of the things that, you know, when I first hit me with Rolling Thunder, and Denise, you remember this, we were up there at Rolling Thunder, and we were outside the Lincoln Memorial on Reflecting Pool right there and getting ready for the whole program. We were all speaking, and some of our old buddies came over in a Black Hawk taking photographs. Remember that?
I remember.
And we actually looked up at the guys, and we knew who was in the helicopter trying to control the situation, and I remember we all gave them a real proud salute, didn't we? I mean, I just it's terrifying, because to think about all the stuff we did, all the years we did, and all of the lies and everything that we've had to live with and go on, and I'm not sure where and if it'll ever end. Mike, could you give us a little history of what's been done trying to resolve the POW issues and then go on what you think needs to be done?
Well, I don't. What has been done is we've lost a number of key people, which I just mentioned a while ago. Colonel Hopper, a great patriot American, Patty Skelly, now Petty Hopper, who married Colonel Hopper, Ted Sampley, John Top, Holland, Delores Alphon. We've lost those four key people on behalf of prisoners of war. Our government is, I think what they're trying to do, they're just trying to stall this till it dies a natural death. And I used to go to Rolling Thunder quite a bit on every year. I'm not a biker, but by my involvement on prisoners of war, I used to go up there every year. And I got in my personal feeling, I thought it was sort of like an atmosphere. You know, everybody gathered up here one time a year, Memorial Day, Sunday, for Rolling Thunder, and I worked on behalf of prisoners of war year-round, and it just well for a certain time. And I think they actually, some of the people may have got involved in just for the party atmosphere, and that was not my intent, never has been, never will be. And I don't believe in sending people in to fight for this country and walking off and leaving them. And I think there are people in our government would like for this to die of a natural death. And now, we had, I was tied in with Delores Alphon's group, the National Alliance of Families, and I felt that we had some officers come out of the Pentagon over there on a Saturday, and I think the last time I went up there, but I pretty well, I wasn't too happy when I left there, because they were talking about, well, we're going to start up here in Laos, northern Laos, in about 3 years. We're going to be down to the bottom of the country and looking for live American POWs. Well, there's not going to be no live American prisoners of war 25, 30 years later in them places. And Ronald Reagan, as president, his number one priority was live American prisoners of war. And all they're doing is looking for remains. Well, dead people can't talk. And we do know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that our government has walked off and left live American prisoners of war. And I've got a book here in my hand right now. It's a POWMI fact book put out by the Department of Defense, October 1992. And I go over on page 14 of the book. At the top of page 14, it's got evidence of capture of unreturned U.S. personnel. Well, one of the guys in there was David Harlickley. I know his wife, Carol. She lives in Kansas, a very active lady on field MMIs. And also on page 16, there's Charles Shelton, United States Air Force. They knew he was still alive. And this is government information. Well, being a Marine infantryman, you don't capture dead people. You capture live people. This is government information right there, peeled every fact book put out by our government, and it right there on that top of the page, the evidence of capture of unreturned U.S. personnel. This book, on the date on this booklet, October 1992. That tells me that they knew, and in the early 90s, there was a peeled every Senate Select Committee headed up by John Kerry. Well, you know where he is nowadays. Well, we didn't trust him then, and we don't trust him now. Those activists I deal with had no use for Kerry, and we also didn't have no use for John McCain. Neither of them two individuals, as senators, have never, and I'll repeat that word never, have never supported prisoners of war missing action since they've been back here in the States. You know, John Kerry tried to run for president, and in 2004, and the Swift Boat people shot him down, and I supported wholeheartedly the Swift Boat people, and I'll continue to support him because he is and was unfit for command. And how he got to be where he's at now, I don't know. But my feeling at this time, I think our government, the people in our government, just want this thing to die of natural death, and well, they've had many opportunities to bring live American prisoners of war out of Southeast Asia, in my opinion.
Well, we both, I mean, Denise and I, and I think, Mike, you might have met, we both, Denise and I, have a very good friend from Texas who's done quite a bit on the POW issues, and he's getting definitely older now, and his abilities and everything to go down. But Ross, I mean, is an incredible individual. I mean, Denise and I have both talked to him and worked with him. Denise, you've kept in contact with Ross over all the years, haven't you? Denise?
Was that Ross Perot?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, I've met Ross Perot on several occasions. I also provided, on one of them occasions, I helped provide security for him at a POW function down there in 1993 outside the gates of Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And he had been very involved in PF prisoners of war, and and if you remember, in the early 90s, there was a lot of activity on behalf of prisoners of war. Well, President George Herbert Walker Bush, he created a roadmap for normalization of Vietnam and a roadmap to resolve the issue. And, of course, Clinton got elected in 1992, and he could care less about prisoners of war. He could care less about our military, and basically, he normalized relations with Vietnam to basically shut the door on any leverage we had on behalf of prisoners of war missing action. So that's where we stand, it's unfortunate. I think back many a time about I almost got captured twice over there, and what would have happened to me, and I could have still been over there, and it really hits home with you, and you're involved in something like that, and it's not just me, but they'll do it to me, they'll do it to other people, and it's unfortunate. My heart goes out to the family members that all these years, knowing that they had been lied to by our government about their next of kin that still has not been accounted for.
I think one of the goofy parts about all this, you know, BP, British Petroleum, the big gas oil giant. But then what had happened after we pulled out of Vietnam, eventually BP got all of the assets for the oil wells and everything, again, connected with the French and everything. And so, again, they were down there, you know, producing oil and getting oil out of the Vietnam era. And this is about 2 years ago now, and finally, as a result of all the stuff that happened down there in the Gulf with that oil well that blew up, BP had to sell $7 billion of assets of the oil wells that they had in Vietnam, and they sold that to Apache. And again, Apache is the one that runs Prudhoe Bay. So to me, it was all, you know, coming back with all the lies and all the greed and everything that's happening. It seems to me, you know, if all this stuff came out for truth and they started telling the truth and dealing with the reality was, all these deals that are happening all over the world for incredible amounts of money and greed and everything wouldn't happen, would they?
Well, in my opinion, money talks. You know, that's just reality. Money talks, and the prisoner of war can be expendable, just like they were in World War II and also Korea. And it went into Vietnam the same way there. They normalized relations. There are a number of businesses that want to get into South Vietnam because of business. Well, and that's how, why they lift the embargo and normalize relations with Vietnam so they could get in there and do business and make quite a bit of money. And Kerry had some kinfolk that, I think a cousin that by the name of Forbes that wanted to do business in Southeast Asia. And so you know how Kerry is. Well, he's the one to come up there and said all the Vietnam vets were killers and stuff like that. And he had no real proof, and they come up, found out he was lying about it. And that remains to this day. And he is now a representative of our government over as Secretary of the State Department.
Yeah, it seems like it keeps coming around. John, have you been able to join us? Are you on the air by chance? Okay. Mike, I talked to John the other day,
yes,
you know,
sir,
and asked him if he could join us, and I don't know if he's listening in or if he wants to, but John, if you're on, please come on in, or either that, just listen in. John is Mike's brother, so we're all good friends. The POW issues, what have the families gone through in all these years? I mean, that's 40 years ago now. You know, obviously the parents for a lot of POWs that were caught are long gone, but there's still family members out there that remember their husbands and their brothers and their sisters and everything. What has been the experience of the families?
Well, some of them have been disheartened and big time. They've been lied to by our government. I've imagined quite a few of them have been frustrated dealing with our government, given false information, lied to, whatever, to basically shut it down. And I have known by my involvement going to the National Alliance conferences and forums up there in D.C. That met them, and my heart goes out to those families that have their next of kin, their sons, their brothers, their fathers, or whatever, still not been accounted for. And it really breaks your heart to see these mothers and the rest of the family members and so forth, children, that knowing that our federal government walked off and turned their backs on these prisoners of war missing action. It's a big bad mark against our government, and it will go down in history as a big bad mark against our government.
And we would think, I mean, when we all enlisted, and again, the people that are still enlisting today, they think that when you enlist, your leaders are going to do what's right. They're going to tell you the truth. Would you get wounded or injured or ill, they're going to provide medical care to you. And what we have all learned and what I continue to learn on a daily basis is that's simply not going to happen. And for me, that's just extraordinarily frustrating. And I know Denise has been working on this for many, many years, just trying to do everything that she can also.
Well, we're finding out a lot about it here recently, how there's been a lot of problems that Obama's got in his short term this second time. And from Fast and Furious to Benghazi, he had four people got murdered. And let me put this out to you. When I was over in Okinawa in 1964, we were on a five-hour mount-out time to go to any hotspot in Southeast Asia. This was 1964. The military had been upgraded quite a bit, and we should have had troops available to protect them people there that got killed there at Benghazi. I hold accountable not only everybody, including Hillary Clinton and President Obama and everybody else up there that lied about this. they've got real-time access to information. Because the reason I say that, when I was over in Vietnam in 64, when we were up at Khe Sanh, and I was on Hill Tiger Tooth Mountain, we had communications with, we were providing security for two operation platoons out of Hawaii and D.C. Well, I found out around 2000, it was actually CIA, and they had direct contact with Washington, D.C. back then. Well, if we had contact with Washington, D.C. back then, then all the modern communications, they had direct contact with what was going on in Benghazi. And from that, and after the, going after the Tea Party and Associated Press and all that, and it's all coming out that we just, our government, in my opinion, is very corrupt. And it's unfortunate they're not representing the American people, because it just ain't doing it. And people that are letting people in this, into our country are not legal, and they're going after law-abiding citizens on the Second Amendment. I know you, as a member of the Armed Forces, we swore an oath of enlistment against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and I think these people up in D.C. have sworn the same oath, and they're not doing anything to protect us, and we're basically on our own as far as I'm concerned. And I'll turn it back to you, Doug.
That's pretty frightening. You know, when I think all the stuff that's happening, the POW issues and all the lies and deceit and everything else that's taking place and all the abandonment that have happened, what groups or organizations today are still involved? I mean, obviously, you know, Rolling Thunder, we've got that. We got, you're with the, what, Vietnam Veterans of America, John, Michael?
Yeah, I belong to Johnson County Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 990 in Smithfield, North Carolina. They're not very active on prisoners of war such as I am, because I've been highly active. I've distributed over 100,000 prisoner of war missing action decals, and I don't get paid for what I do. I do it because it's the right thing in my mind to do, and I will continue working on it, and don't have too many organizations working on it nowadays. I got a good friend up in Kentucky named Danny Belcher. He's with Task Force Omega.
I've met Danny before.
He's a heck of a great patriotic American, and he and I knew each other from our involvement on POWs, working with Colonel Earl Hopper. And you got people like him, like I said, we lost Dora Loris Alphon the last few years, and she was head of National Alliance. I met her other sister, but I really have had no contact with them. But I do, if I need any information on prison of war I don't understand or don't know, I contact Patty Hopper, Colonel Hopper's wife, and she lives out in Glendale, Arizona, and I can either go to her on information. If I can't, I'll go to somebody else, like Danny or Sammy Davis, and that's basically, we lost some real good patriotic Americans working on it. So,
well, you know, unfortunately, I mean, we're talking about, you know, the age, and that just creeps up on you no matter what you're going to do. We're not young puppies anymore, although we, you know, like I do, I used to be able to leap four-story buildings at a single bound. Well, I'm down to a single-story building now. That depends on whether it's a good day or a bad day.
Yeah, I'm on a single step, so I'm 67
years
young.
I mean, your
young
brother and I have fun, you know, we're teasing each other, trying to just get our meals and get from the dining room back to the table after we get our meal.
You got that right. I think a lot of my brother Jack, and I'm very one of the biggest things I'm really proud of, I want to mention on the air here, is I'm very proud of my brothers. There were six of us boys in my family, and two of them served in the Army. They went to Germany, and the other four of us served in the Marines. Three of us served in Vietnam. I ended up going there a second time, and I'm very proud of them, and also I'm proud of the people in the Franklin community and businesses that helped get that Rankin Memorial built, especially Maggie Diskin. She was head of it, and they put up a very nice memorial recognizing those that served in from the Rankin community in the military.
Well, I know your brother here, since, I mean, he's a good friend of mine, and we do get together all the time. I mean, he's extraordinarily active in writing letters to the newspaper and keeping all these issues in front of everybody and trying to do what he can, so it must be in your blood somehow.
Well, I used to write letters to the editor, but I'm not as good a writer as I am. I did other stuff, tried to get involved. I just got involved with another motorcycle group. They're very good. Most of them are military, retired law enforcement, or active duty law enforcement. I had my VFW post with, we went up here at Knightdale, North Carolina, which is just on the outskirts of Raleigh, and they invited us up there to set up a table and do our thing on military, and they treat us very nice, and I think we're hooking up with them, and we do a lot of stuff. My Vietnam Veteran American Group, Smithfield, which is probably about 35, 40 miles north of Fayetteville, North Carolina, we're home of Fort Bragg, and we feed the wounded warriors down at Womack Army Hospital, and also there the wounded warriors at Camp Lejeune. Last year, not only done those two places, but also Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, which is 30 miles south east of me, and also Marine Corps Air Station at Cherry Point. And we get items donated, such as barbecue and buns, and we got the peaches that were donated out of South Carolina. I got a retired Army Sergeant Major, a good friend of mine, lives here in Wilson, North Carolina, which is east of me, 12 miles. And he's the one that initially got us started, and he basically headed up. And we got a good group of people down there in our Vietnam Veteran America chapter in Smithfield. We got 113 members who keep growing, and most of them, I think, are 101st Airborne. But we got a good group of people, and I think the reason our group is outstanding is that all of them come out of the military either as an NCO or above. And my hat is off to those people that I work with on that. And we are making headroads, and we are getting very well respected in the community here, not only where I live at, which is 25 miles north of Smithfield, but we're getting very well known, and that's what it's all about. As long as you're doing good things, you should get good results, and that's what's happening with us.
What can people do, or what would you like people to take away from this? What can they do to help resolve the POW issue? Who do they need to contact? What do they need to ask to be done?
Well, be honest with you, Doug. I wouldn't bother anybody in the government. In my personal opinion, I wouldn't bother anybody in the government. If you got a legitimate POW organization within your communities that are working on it, those would be the people I would contact. I work by myself because I got frustrated. Like a veterans organization, they have 12 meetings a year, one each month. And to me, these POWs, they're prisoners of war, not just one time a month. They're prisoners of war every day of the year. That's 365 days. And that's why I went out on my own. Some of these organizations, they're a veterans organization. They're more or less a party organization, you know, a social club, I think, I consider. And I'm not into that. They're not as involved in prison war as I am because, you know, some of these guys that serve in the military have never actually been out there and got shot at like I have in the rice paddies and Triple Canopy Jungle. And I would think if they would check within their community, if they can go online and check for POW organization and talk to the individuals in charge of them, then they might be able to find somebody. But right now, there's the only two main organizations I know of is National Alliance of Families, and I think they're nationalalliance.org is on the website, and also Task Force Omega Incorporated.org out of Glendale, Arizona, headed up by Colonel Hopper's wife, Patty. Those are two main organizations. Also, Danny Belcher there in Kentucky, and that's about as far as I can come up with. I'm not too interested. You got Ann Mills Griffin, who has of an organization, but a lot of people that were involved with it fell out, and that's how the National Alliance of Families got formed up. So those are the only ones I know of I would support. Because if they're not legit, I don't want really have nothing to do with myself, because I'm wasting my time and all that. We're basically down in the bottom half of the ninth inning as far as PLWMIA is concerned, because I come 67 years young, and we do not have that many people out there working on it.
Denise, have you been able to join us again?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, what have you got anything, Denise, you need to want to bring up or say on this? We got about 7 or 8 minutes left.
Yeah, I've been in National Vietnam before, but has Dan Belcher as our vice chairman and the PSFP issues. So we are there still doing that, and I want to remind everybody, and before we move to Afghanistan, we need Sergeant Quickly Burdock out of there. He's been held captive, and before we pull ourselves out, we need to count him brought home, and we know he's alive and held at Afghanistan. Are you there?
Yeah.
So the National Vietnam and Gulf War Veterans Coalition is a umbrella organization, and Danny Belcher is our POW/MIA chairperson, and we Wellington is part of that coalition group. With other groups that are still interested and haven't let the issue die. In fact, I have an author who suggests for a future show that wrote a very good information from Time and his own books, Rachel. If I'm remembering his last name correctly, but he spoke at one of the coalition breakfasts a year ago, 2 years ago. So he's still with us. He did a interview with NPR, National Public Radio, in 2010, I believe. So it'd be considered to follow up with and keep the issue alive. So many of the American public are not educated. A lot of citizens' organizations went along with political bill that they were deaf. And that's all politically driven. And we've lost a lot of, as has already been mentioned, Jim Stampley, John Collins. I mean, these were figures that did not give a fight until they died. That was their mission, to try to get the answers and get our people home.
Yeah, I think the whole Vietnam War and everything that we experienced has just have a devastating and lingering effect. I mean, we've got all the POW issues. We still have incredible problems with Agent Orange. And now, Denise, you and I have continued to work on the Agent Orange issues, trying to get medical care everybody and getting that report out. I mean, Joyce Riley and was able to get a hold of that report, as did our nurse on our team, another nurse, and getting that report out confirming all of the health effects from Agent Orange that Zumwalt wrote, I mean, over 20 years ago. And yet I distinctly remember, Denise, you and I were at the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, and when we all presented, he was still denying any correlation between all the environmental exposures and the toxic effects. And he knew better. I mean, that whole day was so frustrating because, I mean, the look on his face when he was lying, and you and I had been, you know, talking to him beforehand, then he wouldn't even talk to us afterwards. Remember that, Denise?
Yep, I do.
It just goes to show, I mean, what the horrible, horrible effects of all this stuff is. And I'm not sure how to resolve it because we continue to fight for it, trying to get medical care for everybody, trying to get the environment cleaned up. I mean, Vietnam is an environmental catastrophe as a result of Agent Orange, and that's from 40 and 50 years ago. And the lingering effects are going to continue unabated.
Well, we're getting the aftertaste now. You know, found out about the Agent Orange, I think it was in the 80s sometime, but up there where I was at, up in northern South Vietnam, they sprayed over 500,000 gallons of Agent Orange. Well, if it's got something, they got stuff to kill weeds and bugs and stuff like that, then it's got to have an effect on the human body, and it has.
Yeah, well, we're running out of time. You know, Michael, I'd like to thank you very, very much for everything that you've been doing and helping us and bringing this up. Jack, John, your brother, I can't thank enough for putting this all together. Denise, as always, we need to continue this conversation and talk more about the POW and all the other issues. So let's keep in touch, and we'll put everything together. So anyhow, I'd like to thank everybody. God bless America. We do have Memorial Day coming up here in a short time. Here at Rantoul at Chanute Air Force Base, we've got a special event where we have 10 free flights being given, a World War trainer, steerman flight trainer. So if people are interested, they can contact us here in Rantoul at Chanute Air Museum. And we'll just go on from there. Well,
thank
God
you.
Bless you, Mike. Thank you, Denise. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
We're going to do this
thank
again.
You.
Good evening, ladies and
God
gentlemen.
Bless.